This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on January the 21st, 2000. Our speaker tonight is Laurie of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi everyone, my name's Laurie. I'm an alcoholic. And you know, it's really great to be here tonight. I didn't think I was going to say that, but it truly is. I want to do something different tonight. I want to welcome the six newcomers, Janice, Tim, Mike, Don, and Rich. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you stay. This is the place to be. And welcome to our visitors. You might have noticed we booed one of our visitors, and that means we love her. Diana used to be a member of this group, so when people come back from, you know, where they've moved to, we boo them because we love them. And then I also want to welcome the 15, maybe 16 now, court cards. I kind of came in that way, so we'll talk a little bit about that. I'll talk a little bit about that because you get to listen and I get to talk tonight. But I want to do something different. I wanted to see who's out there. So I want to do like a real quick sobriety countdown. So if there's anyone here that has over 20 years of sobriety, can you stand up real quick? Let us see who you are. All right. Thank you. How about anyone from 15 to 20? 15 to 20, and that's me. All right. 10 to 15. All right. And how about 5 to 10? Woo! Four to five. All right. Three to four. Two to three. One to two. Months to 1 year. Oh, wow. 90 days to 6 months. Yeah. And then up to 90 days. Anybody from 0 to 90? Thanks. Thanks. A lot of sobriety here tonight. A lot of sobriety. So welcome all of you. You know, they told me when I got here, they told all of us when I got here that if you feel like committing suicide when you're sober, because I never felt like committing suicide when I was drinking, okay? But when I got sober, I started feeling like committing suicide occasionally. But if they said if you feel like committing suicide before you're 5 years old, you know, don't do it because you'll be killing a stranger. And that was my experience, you know. Actually, I've changed so much in this program, I've been a stranger the whole time. So I'm still pretty strange. My sobriety birthday is January 18th, 1983. And that means I celebrated 17 years of sobriety on Tuesday. It also happens to be my natal birthday. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, though. And I just got to tell you, you know, I am so grateful for sobriety. I am so grateful to be sober. And this week has been so filled with love for me. Some friends of mine threw a little party, a little dinner party for me after the 6 o'clock meeting, which I chaired here. And, you know, my heart's just filled. It's been a great week. And it's really great to see some real good friends out in the audience tonight. And I just appreciate your support. And I brought some Kleenex just in case. this is a good deal. It's the best deal in town. And I didn't really know that when I got here. I grew up virtually an only child. And I say virtually because I had a sister that was 20 years my senior. So, you know, it's just the same as being an only child. I don't remember much about my childhood, to be honest with you. I don't know why that is. I think I didn't want to, is what I think. But when I was 3 years old, my folks picked up from L.A., where they had been living for a really long time. They were really stable there. And we moved to a little town called Indio, California, which is in Southern California, down by Palm Springs. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And way back then, it really was out in the middle of nowhere. We moved there supposedly because of my dad's bad back. And it was supposed to, I don't know how, you know, the desert makes your back feel better. But. And being, you know, my folks were a lot older because I had this sister that was 20 years my senior. So my folks were a lot older. And, you know, really, I had a pretty good childhood. They spoiled me rotten, got everything I wanted. I learned how to manipulate really quick. You know, if my mom wouldn't give me what I wanted, I went to my dad. I mean, I learned how to do that one. And my folks didn't drink. They didn't seem, to outward appearances, to be dysfunctional much at all. And growing up, they put me right into the church, which was right across the street from my house. So I grew up a little Christian girl, and I got very involved in the church at a young age, and I kind of got obsessed with it. And in thinking back, I wonder if, you know, I wonder, I don't know if we're born alcoholics or if we cross a line. I always have said that I think I was born an alcoholic just because I seem to have obsessive compulsive tendencies all my life. You know, I don't know. But I know that I did have obsessive compulsive tendencies all my life. And one of them was my church experience. So from the very beginning, I just spent a lot of time in church. And I think, you know, I'll tell you a little bit later about some stuff that came down for me, but I think it was is part of an escape mechanism for me. When I was, my memories start, you know, kind of around 7 or 8 years old, and I had an experience around that time that taught me a lot about relationships. I had a favorite uncle. His name was Jack. And he was I had two favorite uncles, Uncle Jack and Uncle Sid. And this one particular time, Uncle Jack was, they were down visiting, him and his mom, I mean his wife. And whatever, yeah, right, the same thing. Thank you. Yeah, I like it. Some help from the crowd there. And my parents were off doing something, so my Uncle Jack was babysitting me. And I loved my Uncle Jack. I really did. He was one of my favorite uncles. And I don't remember all of this, but we were in the living room, and I was sitting on his lap. And my Aunt Grace was taking a bath. And Uncle Jack wanted to play with me. And I didn't know what that meant. And I wanted to please my Uncle Jack. But he said it needed to be a secret. And I had this thing about secrets. And I somehow knew the secret wasn't okay. But, you know, he was my Uncle Jack. And I love my Uncle Jack. And I wanted him to love me. You know, I always wanted people to love me. And I drank a lot behind that. So Uncle Jack wanted to have, you know, do whatever Uncle Jack wanted to do. And I wanted to let him do that. And I don't think it went as far as it could have gone. Because what happened is, that secret. He kept talking about this needing to be a secret. We weren't going to tell anybody. It was going to be our special little secret. And you know what I did? I freaked out. And I ran away from him. And I ran into the bathroom. And I told his wife, my aunt, what he was doing. And she freaked out, needless to say, bundled my ass up, took me to my grandparents, dropped me off, and left me there. And do you know, I never saw my Uncle Jack ever again. We never heard from them ever again. When my parents came to pick me up at my grandparents' house, we talked about it for a second, and then we never talked about it again. And that was something that happened in my family, is we didn't talk about stuff like that, you know. And that didn't happen a lot, but I'm here to tell you that if you're a woman or a guy and anything like that happened to you when you were little, that's abuse. And I don't know about you, but I drink behind that shit. Okay. Maybe that's when I crossed the line. I don't know. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 16 years old, and I'll never forget. And what happened before that was I had gotten into high school and junior high, and that was really uncomfortable. High school and junior high was uncomfortable. I don't know what it was, but it was like I started not feeling a part of. And maybe it was, I don't know, but I started not feeling a part of, and I started feeling uncomfortable. And actually, I remember in sixth grade, a bunch of girls from another school ended up coming over to our school. And I wanted so badly for them to be my friends. And I tried really hard to be popular and to be part of their group. And they kind of let me in their group, but they didn't really. And I don't know, it was just really tough. And I went into junior high, and people started drinking and partying a little bit. And I didn't know anything about that because my parents didn't drink at all. There was just no alcohol in my family at all. I didn't really know anything about it. The only experience I'd had with alcohol was when we were on vacation one time. We went to visit one of my dad's friends, and this guy got drunk. And in the middle of the night, I heard him crashing around in the kitchen, and I went out and checked him out. And it kind of scared me because I saw this guy kind of crashing around. He didn't even notice me, and I just ran back into the bedroom. And I asked him later what that was, and my dad said, oh, he must have had too much to drink. And that's all it was. So I didn't know about alcohol until I got into junior high and high school, and I started seeing the kids drinking and kind of maybe not even using, just drinking. But you see, I was a really good little church girl. And I knew it wasn't okay to drink based on what the church taught me. You know, God would get you if you did that sort of stuff. So it wasn't okay to drink. But I kind of think, you know, I was a little curious about it. And when I got into high school, I started dating this guy that was a couple years older than me. He was a junior. I was a freshman. And the group he hung around with partied. And I'll never forget the first time I really remember, you know, alcohol was at the California Jam down in Southern California. It was the very first California Jam. I was totally clean and sober, you know. And all these people I went with were drinking, and they had ice chests, and there was a bazillion people, man, and they were getting all shit-faced. And I was, like, watching, and I was, like, innocent, you know, but I was checking them out, and I think it piqued my interest, you know. It's like, what are these guys doing? It looks like they're having fun. And I actually took a sip of one of their drinks and, you know, just gave it back real quick. But it was like, So as a consequence of dating this guy, I didn't go to church on Sundays for about a month. And like I said, I was obsessive about church. But see, what I do with guys is they become my life, okay? So I've always been a chameleon. And if I want you to like me, or if I'm going out with you, or, you know, I'm going to do what you do. Forget what I care about. Forget what I like. So I've been going out with this guy, and I forgot about church. Even though I had gone to church for 10, 12 years, every day, three times a week, whenever I could go, I had gone. But here I go dating this guy, and church is out the window. And that's kind of, you know, the story about me and guys. We'll have more of that. I always liked guys. My first boyfriend I had when I was 3. So, didn't have sex then, but anyway, I went back to church. So this guy broke up with me, actually, because I wouldn't have sex with him. And because, you know, I was going to be a virgin until I got married, right? That's what you're supposed to do. So I wouldn't have sex with this guy, and after about a month, he broke up with me. And then I went back to church. Now, you know, I'm not sure if my memories are real clear on this, but I can swear, and I really have believed this, all my sobriety and all my drinking, that when I went back to church that Sunday, after not being there for a month or so, I think I heard someone say, oh, look, there's Larie. She's redeemed herself. Okay? Like, I was out there partying and stuff with those guys that I was hanging out with, and I wasn't. I was being a good girl. But I wonder now if maybe that was just an excuse. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, I didn't fit in church anymore. And now I wonder if I had already made a decision that I wanted to go try that shit out. And I knew I wasn't okay being in church. Anyway, I got a resentment against my church. And I decided that, screw those people. I mean, what the hell? And even though I wasn't going out with this guy anymore, it was time to try out this alcohol stuff. Now, just as a little side note here, that guy broke up with me because I wouldn't have sex with him, and guess who he started going out with? My best girlfriend. And, you know, that happened a lot to me. I mean, even younger than that. My boyfriends always liked my best girlfriends. I hated that. I learned really early not to trust women. And when I came into these rooms and I had to get a woman sponsor and I had to make friends with you women, I did not even like that. I learned very early not to trust men. Who are you going to trust if you don't trust men and women? Kind of have a problem. Anyway, so I was hanging around with this same crowd of people that that this guy I'd been dating hung around with, and they drank and partied, and I had my first drink of alcohol, and it was a Coors beer. Tasted like shit. Ugh. But man, it did something to me. It did something to me. I liked, and the book talks about it, the effect produced by alcohol. Had nothing to do with the taste. It never did for me. And I got drunk that night, and I blacked out that night. They told me I was barking like a dog and doing some other weird things. And I don't remember. So most of the rest of my story, and I've heard people say this, and it's true for me, most of the rest of my story really is hearsay, because I just blacked out all the time. I was a blackout drinker. I also want to say that this is my story, and all of this is my opinion. You know, so just keep coming back for yourself. That's what this is about, you know. Immediately, the next day, I started planning my next drunk. And this is where I think I crossed the line. Either I was born an alcoholic or I crossed the line right away, because my next drunk, I was going to have a six-pack. I mean, I got drunk on one beer. I got shit-faced and blacked out. Why do I need a six-pack? I don't know, but I was going to drink a six-pack. And this is the way I live my life, you guys. It's black or it's white, okay? There's nothing in between. So if I like it, I'm going to go for it all the way, right? And it's like once I made that decision to start drinking, I'm going for it. Forget everything I learned back here in church. As a matter of fact, you, God? Oh, yeah. Well, you're not going to like the way I drink. So I'm just going to set you right up here on this shelf, because I always knew deep inside that God was the answer. I always knew that. But, you know, I knew I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink and still have God in my life. So I put him up on a shelf, and I said, I'll get back to you later, but I'm going to go party. And I planned that next drunk, and I went out that Friday, and I bought me a six-pack. Seemed to be able to get beer easier than hard liquor at that time. Got me a six-pack, and that night, I think I drank seven just to make sure I had six. And I don't know what's up with that, but, you know, it's like I had to have six. And every weekend thereafter, that's how I drank. As much as I could, as often I could, and I seemed to have a really high tolerance. I could drink alcohol. You know, I could drink guys under the table, and I loved it. I loved it. It took me out. That's where I went. It was not about social drinking. Hello, how are you? Nah. It's like, let's get fucked up, you know? And I just, that's how I drank. Recently, I've reconnected with some friends of mine from high school, and that's been truly a gift. Truly a gift, because these people, I thought, hated my guts, and truly they love me. But, I've been sober a long time now. Changed a lot. And some of those friends are those girls in sixth grade that I wanted to be so tight with. And I was thinking about a couple of my experiences drinking. There was this wedding that I was not invited to. But it was going to be a real cool wedding, you know, one of those golf course clubs up on the hill down in Indio. And all the cool people were invited, and I was not. And my girlfriend and took me and my other girlfriend with her. You know, so we crashed the party. And I used to get drunk before the party. You know what I mean? I had to get drunk to be comfortable going to the party, because I just wasn't comfortable hanging out with people and chatting with people or whatever. You know, I needed to get loaded before. So oftentimes my girlfriends and I would go to Patty's house, and we'd drink a bottle of Annie Green Springs each, and we'd smoke some dope, and then we'd go to the party. And that's what had happened, you know, going to this wedding. And there was this guy, Brian, that kind of, he's like my high school sweetheart, and I chased him a lot. Well, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but that's okay. So we go to this wedding, and it's open bar. Didn't you love the open bar weddings? Oh, yeah. And I always took real advantage of that. You know, I kind of hung out at the bar. And I got so drunk that night that when it was time to leave, they said, okay, my girlfriend Sandra that I'd come with said, okay, it's time to go. So I went to leave, but nobody followed me. And I guess I ended up picking up on the car parker out there. Because I was standing around waiting for them to come, and nobody was there, so here's a cute guy, you know, let's check him out. And the next thing I know, I'm laying on the grass with the car parker. Obviously, he wasn't getting anybody's car. And one of the little daughters went in and announced to the party that I was out making out with the car parker, and they come running out to get me. Well, by that time, I'd fallen down in the middle of the street. My nylons are ripped. I have bloody knees, and my friends haul me home. They were totally embarrassed of me. And my friend Gary, he was one of those guys that always kind of took care of me. He took me into my house and would tuck me in, you know, take care. He was Sandy's boyfriend. He would take care of me. And the next morning, the phone rang. And I woke up. I was totally hungover. And it was the car parker. I guess I'd given him my phone number. And, you know, I'm in a blackout. I was totally blacked out that whole time. So I answer the phone, hello. And he's like, hey, baby. You know, I'm like, hey, baby, what? He was devastated that I didn't remember who he was. So I'm trying to fake it. Did you ever do that? You know, try to fake it to pretend like you knew what you were talking, who you were talking to, and that you know. I did that a lot too. I tried to fake it, and I don't think I did very well. Hung up and called my friend Sandy. Sandy, what the hell happened? You know, and she's like pissed at me. Lorraine, you totally blew it. I always heard that. You totally blew it last night. I don't even want to talk to you. Oh, come on, come on, come on. What'd I do? What'd I do? No, I'm not telling you. That's it. You've done it this time. She hangs up on me. You know, and I was left to try to figure out what the hell I had done one more time. And that's the way it was for me. Brian, the way I met Brian was I used to work at like a Macy's. And I worked with this girl, and one day she was really excited because her brother was coming home. Now, her brother was a loser. I mean, and these are the guys that I really liked, right? Okay, this guy was in juvenile hall, and she's telling me, I'm so excited, my brother's coming home. You know, he's been in juvenile hall for, I don't know, 6 months, and, you know, he got so drunk, he burned the bed he was sleeping on at his brother's house because we couldn't live at his parents' because he was so much trouble, so we sent him to his brother's, and he burned the bed up. Now they're sending him back, you know. It's really, really, but I'm excited he's coming home, and I said, I want that guy. You know, I mean, I was ready before he even got there. And so he comes in, she gets him a job, and sure enough, man, he was really cute. And I went after him. Dumped my boyfriend. My boyfriend at the time, his name was David Stiff. Oh, I hated that. He was a football player, and he had a football jersey stiff across the back. Man, I hated that. Anyway, I dumped David, and, you know, I went after Brian, and that's like, oh, my God. And Brian is the one that turned me on to drugs.
Yeah.
Every drug Brian turned me on to. And I got to say that because drugs are a part of my drunkalogue. But the first time I ever tried barbiturates, we had gotten like 6 reds, and we were going to do them after Brian got off work. And I was with my friend Sandy again, and I told her I had these reds. We were drinking. You always drank. Always, always, always. There was never a time I wasn't drinking. And she said, we should do those reds. And I go, I can't. You know, I'm saving them until Brian gets off work, and then he and I are going to do them. She goes, yeah, but we'll just go get some more. I go, okay. So we each had one. And we waited, because I didn't know what's supposed to do, right? Waited 15, 20 minutes, nothing happening. I said, nothing's happening. She goes, yeah, let's do another one. Okay, so we do another one, waited 20 more minutes, nothing's happening. Well, by now, Sandy's kind of getting a little buzzed, but I am not. I hate that. And then I'm thinking, I got to go get some more, because I got to have 6 by the time I go pick him up, so he doesn't know, you know, like, I'm going to be really coherent by that time. So we go, and we get some more, and anyway, by the time I picked up Brian, I think we'd taken like 4 each. And I was loaded. And Sandra was loaded, and Brian got mad because, you know, we had 4 each, and he had none, so he took 4, then we had to go get some more. Anyway, the next time, we took like 10 each that night. And we were driving around. And I remember we ran into Indio Park, because there was this road, and it teed at Indio Park, right? We're driving, and Brian's driving. He always drove. He shouldn't have, like I could have. And we went to turn the corner, and we missed the corner, and we ended up, like, banging into the curb at Indio Park. And what happened, I was in a little Volkswagen Bug, and it bent my axles, okay? So we're facing the wrong way on the street, and we got the car off the sidewalk, and the axles are bent, and we are so wasted, and we got quarts of Colt 45 each. And we get out of the car, and we go, well, man, it's fucked up. It's so... I go look, and we have a problem, you know? So Brian, he's smart. He goes, and he gets my flat spare out of the trunk, and he's going to put the flat spare. Well, I know it's not a flat. It's the axle. So I get over, and I'm going to pull the sucker out, right? So I'm down there pulling out, trying to pull the axle straight when the cops drive up. And I go, oh, there's the cops. Bummer. So I go around to the side of the car right in front of the cops, get my cord of Colt 45 right in front of them, walk back around, hide behind the car and pour it out on the street, put the cord behind the wheel and act like nothing's happening. The cops come over and they go, oh, bottle of Colt 45 right there. Can I have that, please? I'm like, oh, yeah, here you go. They said, okay, want to see your license. Yeah, okay. All right, Ms. Cobb, let's have you walk a straight line here, you know? No problem. Grab onto the car, walk a straight line. And they go, no, no, no. That doesn't work. You've got to let go of the car. Oh, shit. So I go, okay, give me a second. Let go of the car, fall down. They go, you're going in. Brian's over there poking his eyes out, you know. They take us to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. I am, like, we're making out in the back of the car. And then I go, excuse me, I got to pee. Can you pull over, please? They're like, no, we're taking you to jail. Fuck you, I got to pee. You know, I mean, I just had no respect for these police officers. Imagine that. They get us to jail, and I'm like, we get out of the car, I start walking that way. You know, they're like, no, you have to come this way. I mean, it was just a big fiasco. I go into jail, I'm yelling and screaming, banging on the door, let me out of here, let me out of here, drama queen to the max. They call my mom, she picks me up, she says, honey, what happened? I go, God, Mom, I don't know, you know. I, like, had one beer. She goes, well, honey, you really, you know, probably shouldn't drink that. Oh, yeah, I know. I will never do it again, Mom. I mean, my mom was pretty naive. Okay, so, you know, that's just how I drank, you guys. I just did as much, as often, just as I could. And that went on. I wrecked cars a lot. I wrecked other people's cars. My dad had told me that I couldn't let anybody drive my car because we were only covered by insurance if I drove. And so he pounded it into my head that never, 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 never let anybody drive your car. And there was many, many times I should have let someone else drive my car. You know, but oh no, I can drive, no problem. I got 3 drunk driving arrests by the time I got here. The last one I had 0.27 blood alcohol level. Okay? And I was thinking about, that's been a long time, and I was thinking, you know, was it really 2.7? Maybe it was 1.7. And I go, no, because 0.08 is considered inebriated right now. So, no, 2.7, you guys. I mean, I drank a lot, and that's almost dead. And I would still, the problem with my drinking is I would still function. You know, I didn't pass out. I wish I had passed out. But I would still function, kind of just do things. I don't know what I did half the time. I remember one time I woke up in Hawaii. I had gone there on purpose. But in Hawaii, you know, you could drink when you're 18. So, that was great. And it's a long story how I got there. But anyway, I was out partying with some guys I met at the naval station, and then I dropped them and went with some other guys, and then I blacked out. And the next thing I remember, it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting in a car in front of a liquor store with a guy who I've never seen before. His son is in the back seat. And he is trying to talk me into having sex with his son. And I know this has happened to some of you. Well, not that particular thing, but where you kind of wake up and you're talking to somebody, you're having this conversation, but you don't know what you're saying. It's like you enter your body again. And then I always wondered, well, who was there while I was gone? You know, I mean, was that God kind of filling in? And you'd think that would scare you. I mean, it scared me for a second. But that night I was out doing it again. That's wasted, you know. And this guy is trying to have, and I didn't have sex with the guy, but he's like, can you take me home now? I have a headache. When I was 19 years old, I had a hangover one day, and I called in sick from work. And I was in the refrigerator. You know how that is. I mean, you feel like shit, and your stomach hurts, and you know you got to put something in your system. And it's like, what am I going to drink without throwing up? So I'm standing there looking, and the phone rings. And my mother answers the phone. And she starts talking on the phone, and she's having this weird conversation. And I think, oh, my God, Mom is having an affair. I think, no, no way. My mom would never have an affair. So it's like, okay. And I'm eavesdropping on this conversation while I'm, in front of the refrigerator. And after a few minutes, she hangs up, and she lets out a big old sigh. And I close the refrigerator door. I go, Mom, who was that? And she says, I can't tell you. I go, Jesus, what the fuck? What do you mean you can't tell me? I just can't tell you. I go, no, you're telling me, Mom. Who was that? And like I said, you know, I could manipulate anything out of my mom and dad. So after a few back and forths, I can't tell you, she said, well, she wanted to wait till Dad got home, but she said, well, that was Rance St. John. Okay. And that was Joanne's first husband. Now, Joanne is my sister, the 20-year older sister, right? It wasn't around much growing up. I go, okay, yeah, I remember. Joanne had been married before. She goes, well, they got a divorce. And I'm like, no shit, Mom. I mean, now Joanne's married and has a kid. Okay? She says, well, then we adopted you. And I went, you mean Joanne, my sister, is my mother? And my mom says, and I burst into tears. And then big guess what the first thing I wanted to do is go get a drink. Now. It's like, man, give me a drink. I go, Mom, I got to go. She's like, what? You can't go. I said, I have got to go. I have got to go now. She's like, oh, honey. I go, Mom, you don't understand. I've got to go. And I ran down to the liquor store, and I bought me a six-pack, and I ran over to my boyfriend's house at the time. He was a truck driver who lived in a hotel, another one of those classy guys that I picked. And he wasn't home, so I sat there and I guzzled beer as fast as I could, just stop the feeling, stop it. I don't want to be me. When he finally got home, I had a little buzz going on, feeling really sorry for myself. Told him the story, and he goes, "You know what? So big deal. You think you're the only person in the lot, and you know that this kind of thing ever happens to you. It happens to people all the time." So he was a big help. You know, I always pick the supportive, loving guys. I go, well, up yours, and, you know, went back home. And my mom pulls out from the bottom of the china cabinet the pictures of me and my little family, you know, when before my folks got divorced and my grandparents adopted me and took me to Indio, where no one in the world would tell this big secret. And I'm telling you, I was 3 years old when that happened. Three-year-olds remember. I didn't remember, but I knew something was wrong with me. I knew something was wrong with me, or why would that have happened? And I carried that with me, and I drank behind that. And that was a great story at the bar. You know what I mean? You'd drink, too, if you had my life. And the truth is, my grandparents took really great care of me. And so, moving forward, if I talk about them, they're my parents, but they're really my grandparents. My uncle's my aunt, my nephew's my brother, and it's like the whole family knew but me. My whole family knew but me. All my life was a lie. It was a lie. When I got sober, I'd been sober a few months, and a girlfriend of mine in these rooms lied to me. I lost it. I lost it. I called my sponsor. I was like, motherfucker, you lied to me. You know, just I was out there. And she stopped me, and she said, do you know why you're reacting this way? I said, no, she lied to me. You know, and she goes, well, Laree, look at your life. And I went, whoa. They always lied. You know, my life was a lie. When I got here, I started learning how to live. I started getting the truth. Anyway, after I found that out, I realized, man, I'm out of here. You know, you guys were really great. You took care of me. Thank you so much. But I'm on my own. I'm out of here. And I did a geographic, and I moved up here to San Jose. My girlfriend Sandra had moved up here by now because her boyfriend Gary used to get in fights with the Mexican kids all the time down in Indio. I mean, every time we went to a party, we'd be having a really great time, and then all of a sudden, bang, crash! You know, it'd be Gary having a fight, and we'd have to leave because he always was getting in fights. So a bunch of Mexican guys went and shot up his parents' house, so they moved up here to San Jose. Cassandra had some cousins, her uncle was up here. So after a few years, and after this happened to me, I moved up here to San Jose on a big geographic, and what I learned is that you take you with you when you move. I thought it was, you know, I really always thought it was kind of Indio that was my problem. I mean, who lives in Indio, right? I mean, it's like, and people are weird down there. I mean, they would go away to college, and they would come back to live there. They always came back. You know, I could never figure that out. And all my life, I go, when I leave, I'm out of here. I am not coming back. And even today, they all went back. I don't know why they would go back, but I made a goal. I am not going back, and I have not. And I won't. But I came up here and continued my drinking. I became a bartender. Good job to have when you're an alcoholic. By the time I got here, I was a coat clerk. I drank a little too much and kind of spilled drinks and fell down and stuff. So I had, like, I was bartender, then I was cocktail waitress, and then by the time I got here, I was coat clerk. But I got my three DUIs when I got up here. Down in Indio, I could talk myself out of anything. I would cry on cue. They would let me go. I mean, I'd have empty cans in the back of my car. They'd let me go. I got caught for stealing booze from a Lucky's one time, and they were chasing me around the store. I had stolen this bottle, and they saw me, and they're chasing me. I'm trying to stash it, you know. They let me go. So I got away with everything when I was down there, but as soon as I get up here, I start getting busted. And that was, like, really a drag. I wasn't used to that. And the first DUI, it's kind of a gift. The first DUI, they lost. So I got this DUI, went to court, and the judge, kind of said, hey, you might want to go to AA. You know, and that was, like, that was probably 20 years ago, okay? So that's all they did. They go, oh, you might want to go to AA. You might have a problem with drinking, 0.27, you know, small problem. I said, AA, forget it. So then a year or so goes by, and I get another DUI. And I'm like, uh-oh, now I'm going to be in trouble because I already have one. Now I'm getting another. Maybe the little fine's going to be a little bit more this time. So I go into court, and what do you know? They lost the first one. So they said, you're here for your first DUI. And I'm like, yay. And this is cool. So you might want to go to AA. I keep hearing this AA, but, yeah, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't have a problem. So a few years later, I get my third DUI, and now I'm really worried because I'm sure now they found the first DUI, and then I would have three, and I think you had to spend $500 and spend some time in jail at that time. And I was really worried, and when I went into court, they said, that you're here for your second DUI, and so they really did lose the first one, and you might want to go to AA. No, I do not want to go to AA, thank you very much. But I did go kind of stand in line for a second in the little line that they give you information about AA, and it took too long, so then I went home. My last DUI was sometime in November, and I was dating this other really classy guy at that point, who was also an alcoholic. Of course, that's all I hung out with at that point was alcoholics, because, you know, normal people don't drink like we do. And God, time goes fast, doesn't it? His dad was one of us, too. And his dad told me that AA was really a good place to go and that I might want to go there because I was going to get in trouble in some way with the courts, and you guys were really cool, and you would probably write a letter for me that I could take down to the courts, and maybe I could get out of doing time or spend a lot of money on fines and so forth. So he took me to my first AA meeting, this guy. He had gone to AA 20 years before because his wife thought that he needed it. And he stayed sober for a little while, and then he just kept drinking. He was doing really well. He lived in a camper shell behind his boss on some vacant lot, and he just pretty much drank the full... And we used to go over there and visit with him and drink, you know. He took me to my first AA meeting at Alano West. Alano East. And that was a trip. I remember going in that room, and the first thing I saw were these steps. And the second thing I saw was that word in step three that begins with a G. And I thought, oh, shit, I'm busted. Because if you remember, I put God up on a shelf about 8 years prior. And... you know, I guess I've always, like I said, I've always known. And I thought, it's time. It's time. You guys told me that an alcoholic was a man or a woman who had lost the ability to control their drinking. And I thought, well, I never really tried to control my drinking. what's the point? You know, I mean, I drank to get loaded. And I think there actually were times I'd go and I'd say, I'll just have three tonight. But by the time I had three, who cared, right? And I'd just keep drinking. I remember when I got here, you guys told me it was the first drink that got me drunk. I go, that's bullshit. It is not the first drink. It is the third drink. Third drink gets me drunk, not the first drink. I had this argument with this woman in a meeting in my early sobriety. She's like, honey, it's the first drink. If you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk. No, it's the third drink, really. Because, you know, when you have the third drink, kind of get that little buzz going, but then you're way past it in a few, you know, an hour or so. Honey, the first drink. God, it took me a long time to get that. I mean, things are so simple, you know, here. And I was always so complicated. So I saw that word God, and I thought, oh, shit, I'm busted. And you guys told me a man or woman lost the ability to control their drinking. So I thought, well, really never tried to control my drinking, so I think I will. Because my birthday was coming up, you see. It was in January when I went to this meeting. A lot of us come to meetings the first time in January. And my birthday's on the 18th, so I thought, I know, I'm going to control my drinking on my birthday. I'm going to go out to control my drinking. I'm only going to have 10. And we'll stop at 10. So by then, I'm drinking Yukon Jack, 100-proof shots. Forget the little drinky poos. I really like kamikazes and flaming gorillas and anything you could drink really fast. As a matter of fact, we went out dancing last week, and this guy ordered a kamikaze, right? I'm like, yay, kamikaze. I love kamikazes. I drink them this big, though. While I was driving, nobody would ever think it was alcohol in a class this big. I used to tell myself, only an alcoholic would drink that. I never got it. But this guy was sipping this kamikaze. I'm like, dude, kamikaze, down it. You know, come on, down it. And he's like, no, I'll sip it. I'm like, God, you don't know how to drink. These normal people really frustrate me. Even now, you know, that was very annoying. But where was I? Yukon Jack, 100-proof shots. So I had a couple before I went to work. By now, like I said, I'm a code clerk. But I used to have to wear, and there's no one, well, I don't think there's anyone in here, but I used to have to wear these shorts that were about this high. And I'd come into AA meetings because I go to work at 10. So I'd come into meetings, you know, 8:30 or 8 o'clock, end at 9:30, go to work at 10. And in my little hot pants and my little outfit, boy, and some of my buddies in here, yeah, Steve might remember, don't ever let me forget that. But I went to the bar, I'm coat clerking away, and I have this friend Tom who only would have 3 glasses of wine. So I thought Tom would be a good one to help me count my drinks, because I certainly couldn't. I knew I was going to black out. Although I didn't know what a blackout was, I just forgot a lot. You know, it took me coming here for it to be labeled a blackout. But I just didn't remember, you know, and that was totally normal for me. I mean, I didn't know anything different. People told me that that other people didn't black out. They remembered everything. Always my friends remembered. They could tell me what I did. But the fact that I didn't remember somehow justified the actions, and I never felt bad for what I did. So I told Tom, please help me. I'm going to control my drinking tonight. I'm only going to have 10. I've already had 3. So, you know, if you would help me count, I'd appreciate it. And he's like, yeah, sure, Larry, whatever. So it's my birthday, they announce it, the band announces it, people start buying me drinks, and, you know, and then they want to snort a little outside and do a little this and that. So, you know, it's my birthday, and pretty soon Tom goes, Larry, you've had 10. I go, well, it's my birthday, Tom. Well, what's up with the 10? You know, he goes, well, you asked me to tell you, you know, when you had 10. I go, I forget it, it's my birthday, I'm going for it. And I just partied all night and went to bed about 5 in the morning. And I woke up the next morning, literally, and I said, shit, I cannot control my drinking. I guess I better go to AA. And I did. I haven't had a drink since. It's truly a miracle. And the streets are much safer, let me tell you. So began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found Saturday Night Live pretty quickly. Room 47 over in Campbell. And this place was hopping. This was the place to be if you were young people. And, man, I'll never forget walking into that first meeting. It was packed. It was probably a Saturday night. And the energy was just so strong. And I thought, yeah. And there were a ton of guys. I like that. And I had my little shorts, so I got a bit of attention. I would sit in the front, and they would ask for newcomers, and I would jump up and go, my name's Larry, I'm an alcoholic. Really, wow. So glad to be here. And I was. I truly was. You know, here I found a place that I fit. And you guys were young, and you were happy, and you were sober. And there was a light in your eyes, and that noise was coming out of your mouth. That laughing thing. I hadn't laughed for a long time when I got here. And man, I heard you laugh, and something inside of me came alive. A little light turned on. And I listened. Because I do everything, like I said, I'm black or white. So once I make a decision to do something, I'm in it. Sometimes that's not a good thing. Sometimes it is. And when I got here, it was. And I thought, you guys told me, 90 meetings in 90 days. Give yourself a break. 90 meetings. Do it. Stay sober for 90 days. If you don't want to stay sober after 90 days, go back out there and get loaded. We don't care. We'd like for you to stay. But if you don't like it and you want to go out, go for it. And I thought, okay, I could do that. Let me try that. 90 meetings, 90 days, get a sponsor, work the steps. I'll give it a try. What have I got to lose? That's what you told me. What have you got to lose? And if you're new here, what have you got to lose? Nothing, I don't think. I mean, if you're here, you know, this isn't like, this is kind of the bottom of the barrel. You know what I mean? I mean, I didn't grow up thinking I want to go to AA when I get big. But remember, I had gotten that third drunk driving arrest, and I was very worried about that because I was going to have to go to jail, and that kind of scared me. And worse than that, I was going to have to spend money, which I didn't like spending money at all, especially giving it to the courts. So I talked to my sponsor about that, and she said that maybe I could get in recovery home. And one day a miracle occurred. I went to court. They sentenced me to 10 days in jail, and I think it was $700 fine or something. I didn't want to go to jail. And I called my sponsor from court. You know, I'm going to spend 10 days in jail. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? She goes, what's the name of your judge? And I told her. She goes, what's the phone number where you're at? And I told her. I go, what are you going to do? She goes, just sit down and I'll call you back. I'm like, do you know the judge? She's like, no, just sit down. I'll call you back. Okay. And I sat down. I waited. About a half hour later, the phone rings. And she goes, go back up to the courthouse and talk to, you know, such and such administrator person or whatever, and he's going to sentence you to recovery home. I'm like, what? How did you do that? She goes, I didn't. God did. And I don't know you guys, but she called that judge who had never talked to her, didn't know her from Adam, left her phone number. He called her back, okay, and she explained my situation. She had been sober, maybe 5 or 6 years at that time, and he heard her, and he gave me a break. And that was my really, you know, the first real miracle that I remember of me just being totally blown away at the power of this program and the power of God in my life. And that hooked me. That hooked me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if God can do that, right, what else could he do? There's something around here that I'd like to talk a little bit about, just because it happened to me, and it's, you may have heard the term 13th step. And the other night I was chairing a meeting, and someone mentioned that, and somebody said, what's that? And I think Jennifer said, stick around and you'll find out. And I just like to tell you what that is, if you're new. 13th stepping is when a man typically, but I think women probably do it too. Oh yeah, the guys say. Oh yeah. Oh, you guys like it when that happens. Come on. Okay, so a man or a woman uses the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to basically get in your pants. And that literally happened to me. There was this guy in here. And you know what? When I got here, I was really messed up. In the area of sex relations were particularly bad. I had used sex to try to get love, as we all do. And you know what? I didn't have any self-esteem when I got here. And I didn't know how to say no. And I wanted to be loved so bad. And there was this guy around here that was very charismatic, and all the women loved him, and he started paying attention to me. And I liked that. And I needed some love, you know? I mean, I was going to go to jail maybe, and I was in a recovery home, and my life was a shambles, and I started getting attention from this guy. But I didn't want to have sex with him. I really didn't. I wasn't ready for that. And he took me to his, and I went to his house. That was smart. I went to his house one day, and he said, come over. That's what he said. He invited me to come over and he was going to read the big book to me. He was going to help me understand. And he did. He read the big book to me for a little while. And then he made his move. And I think I went, no. You know? Because I didn't know how to say no. I did not know how. And I just want to let you know, if you're new here, be careful. Because we're not all wrapped so tight here. And there are people in this room. Well, I don't know about this room. I won't say that. But I'm sure, well, whatever. that will use the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for that purpose. And you know what? We get loaded behind that shit, you guys. We get loaded behind it. And I'm so grateful I didn't. What happened for me is, yeah, I had sex with that guy. And I'm not proud of it. I look at him, he's not around actually, he got loaded, and he's not back. And that's what happens to them sometimes. That messed me up pretty bad. But you know what I did, is I used it as a reason to stay here. And a lot of us don't, and a lot of us can't, and we've lost a lot of members because of that. So I just caution you, you know. The women should stick with the women, and the men can stick with the men until you get a solid foundation in this program. And you can make your own decisions, and you can say no if you need to. I started working the steps, and the first three steps were pretty simple for me. I had a little bit of a problem with the unmanageability of step one, although it's like, hello, Larie, like your car is an alcoholic car, you live with three alcoholics, you're a coat clerk. I mean, is your life unmanageable? step two and three were pretty easy because there was God, and I knew he was the answer, and I was ready to take him off that shelf. Step four, a little more difficult. You know, starting to look at myself and really take an inventory of what I had done. Because, you know, see, my parents adopted me. My grandparents adopted me when I was three, right? My sister, my mother, all that stuff. I mean, I was a victim. Poor me. You would drink, too. And I actually had to come to a place in sobriety where I believe that I made that choice. I believe, this is just me, you guys, so... I've done a lot of spiritual searching and stuff in the time I'm here, and one of the things I believe is we make our choices about who we come in as in this lifetime. So I believe I chose my folks. I believe I chose this life I'm living. And that helped me get out of my victim mode because I couldn't get out of it. You see, it was their fault. They did that to me. They lied to me all my life. Poor me, poor me. And I couldn't get out of it. And through a series of events and some spiritual intervention, I came to a place of believing that I made my choice when I came here. That's just me. But I remember early in sobriety in that recovery home going nuts, just going nuts. And I was so unhappy and I was freaking out and I lived with all these damn women. I hated women and some of them were gay and oh my God. And they wanted to pick up on me and I called my sponsor. Ah! And she said, where are you on your fourth? And it's like, I'm not done yet. Well, finish your fourth. You know, when we do our four steps, stuff starts coming up. We start looking at shit that we've never looked at, writing down resentments, feelings that, you know, whatever those were. I certainly didn't know what feelings were either. Had a little chart that I carried around with me. Feelings, you know. You feel angry, frustrated. What is it? What am I feeling? I don't know. I mean, that was very hard feelings. And I kept avoiding that fourth step, and I kept going crazy. And my sponsor kept saying, do your fourth, do your fourth. And I finally finished that, and I did my fifth. And that was hard. You know, who wants to tell everybody, someone everything? All that stuff. Yuck. Ugh. Garbage can, right? But what a gift to let go of that and to give that away to someone else. To have someone relate to you and tell you, yeah, I know. Yeah, I've been there. Yeah, I've done that. I remember at the end of it, she said, are you done? Is that all? And I went, oh, shit, I forgot something. That one thing that I had forgotten. God bless me. He totally, because if I had remembered, I wouldn't have written it down anyway, right? And because it was pretty bad, you know. Have you forgotten anything she said? And I go, oh, yeah, just one thing. What is it? Do I have to tell you? If you want to stay sober, you have to tell me. And so I told her. And you know that bitch, she upped me, man. She did a better one than me. What a relief. What a relief. I think the first time I did step 6 and 7, I kind of breezed through it. And I got to tell you that recently, you know, this last year has been a tough one for me, man. I got myself into some messy situations over the past year. I made some pretty interesting choices. Like I said, black or white. I still do that. And when I go for something, I go. I do it. And that's okay. You know, I believe we're here to experience life. I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous to be stupid, boring, and glum. And that has not been my experience here. You can live life here. And I just love life today. And I want to live life. So I make choices. I take chances. I take risks today. And I've learned that sometimes the choices I make aren't that great. And sometimes I have to pay the consequences. And all I hope is I don't drink. I don't want to drink or use behind any choices I make today. But this last year, I've worked the steps twice this last year, man. Okay? Because what I have learned here is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are the keys to the kingdom. They are the recovery from our disease. And the first time I got here, I worked through the steps on my alcoholism. But, you know, alcohol is but a symptom of a deeper, darker problem. And I think I have deeper and darker problems than alcohol. Alcohol was a relief for me. It relieved me from those problems. It let me not think about the fact that all that shit happened to me, right? And all that stuff I did and all that. And the tools here are something you can use over and over again. And some people work 10, 11, and 12, and that's the way they maintain their sobriety. And I'm just, you know, I just like to jump in and do it full bore, and I like to go through everything. So I've just finished, I'm kind of on 6 and 7 right now in the last series of steps, and it's like, boy, there's a lot of power in step 6 and 7. This year, you know, I talked a little bit about Brian, and he has been an integral part of, well, not integral, but he's been a part of my life ever since I met him. He got sober before I did, but then chose to get loaded again. And I got sober, and he hates this. I'm going to buy him a copy of this tape, so he's going to hear this. But hi, Brian. He got sober, and then I got sober, and then he got loaded, and I stayed sober. And he is coming up on 5 years now. But throughout, we had some really intense stuff when we were younger and things we had to work through. And amends I owed him, I felt. And I would go back to talk to Brian while he was still getting loaded and try to make amends. And gee, you know, that just didn't work. I don't know what it was about that, but it just didn't work. And that, it kind of tore at me because this situation we had had was very painful for me, and I did some stuff I wasn't proud of, and he beat me up for it for a long time. And it was just a sick thing, and I wanted it to be clean. And 3 Christmases ago, he had been sober a few years. We had an opportunity to spend some time together, and we healed that situation. I asked him for forgiveness, and he told me he forgave me, and it was healed. It was healed. And today, we are really, really good friends. You know, and it's so cool to be friends with people that you got loaded with and that you destroyed each other's life, you know, and to both be sober and walking down this path. And I talk to him a lot on the phone, and it's really cool. And the other thing, remember those girls in sixth grade that I wanted so bad to be friends with? This year I got an email from VJ77654 in this email account that I very seldom use. And one day I go, I should check that email account. I look in, and there's these messages from VJ77654. Who the hell's this? Open it up, and it's my friend Vicky, and she's like, Laurie, is that you? Where have you been? We've been looking for you. You know, we're all going to get together and have a party this year for a certain year that we've all reached. And we want you to come. And I sent her an email back, and I said, yes, it's me. And in November, like 10 girls all got together down in Palm Desert, which is by Indio. So I did go back for a visit. And we had a weekend together where we did a spa, and we, you know, and I got to be designated driver, and you know what? They're all fat, and I'm not. Oh, that felt so good, and they love me. You know, what a gift. I don't know many people that are in touch with their high school friends. And today I came home from my walk, and there was a big box on my front porch, and I thought, what the hell's that doing there? I didn't order anything, did I? And it's from Vicky. She was sending me a birthday present. They're proud of me. They know I need to be sober, you know? When I talked to Vicky about some of my experiences this last year and how I kind of just go, she goes, well, Larie, oh, God, this helped me so much. She goes, Larie, that makes perfect sense. I go, what do you mean? She goes, you've always been that way. I go, really? She goes, yeah, man, you used to scare the shit out of me. You'd bring these weirdos home with you, you know, and you go, hey, this is my new friend Dave, you know, and he's all scraggly and doesn't have any teeth, and, you know, it's like my new friend, and Vicky's like, okay, Larie, you know, and, you know, I would just do these, like, outrageous things, and she said, we worried so much about you. You know, you really do need to be sober, Larie. And that's what happens here. You get healed. You get healed. I mean, even thinking about talking tonight, and I remember in sixth grade, those girls didn't like listening to me. And I would tell them a story, and they would get bored, and they'd start talking, you know. And so then I started talking really fast, so then maybe I'd get my story in really quick before they, you know. And I was thinking, you know, I think this opportunity, because I've never done this for this group, I've never spoken, done a speaker meeting for this group, maybe this is part of that healing. So you guys have to listen to me for an hour. And, you know, I mean, that's the way I look at life today. You know, it all can be a healing. It all is a gift. It's a blessing. I'm lucky to be alive today, you guys. I drove off cliffs. I ran into mountains. I hit fire hydrants. I hit trees. I did a lot of damage while I was getting loaded. And today I don't have to do that one anymore. Today life is good. It's full. It's painful sometimes. But it's a blessing. And I have the gift of the 12 steps that nobody out there has. You know, what are those people? They go to a lot of therapy, maybe, if they even want to take a look at themselves. And we learn here how to take a look at ourselves and how to clean up the past and how to live clean inside and how to have a relationship with a higher power that today I'm learning to call my friend, which is a whole new concept for me. So I want to read something before I close. God, the time goes. I have so much more to tell you. We'll have to do this again. Gail Adams, who was a longtime member of this program, and she died 4 years ago from cancer, like my second sponsor did, used to read this after every one of her talks, and I might start doing that too because it's really powerful. It's called The Keys of the Kingdom. The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments because that is life. But also I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First, through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and a newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness. With that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you so much for letting me pass it on.